Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are finishing up the first half hour of this movie. Boys, I can't believe we got through a half an hour of this movie so far. And we're well on the
way. I can't believe how much we have to go.
Yeah, it's. I don't even want to look at that. Yeah. I don't want to look at the little barometer I have on my spreadsheet, but it's probably something horrifying. But anyway, as long as we have our wonderful listeners checking in and keeping us honest, everything's fine. By the way, 83 episodes tomorrow to record. to let you know. Anyway, with that in mind, speaking of getting beat up, let's get into this particular minute. Hal, catch us up on what's going on in the Alpine Bavarian mountains and Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. Yeah, there's a nice big scene shift halfway through this here. So, all right, minute 30. In Dr. Zola's laboratory, the air hums with the faint strains of Ein Schwert für Hieß mir der Vater. Johann Schmidt, his shadowy face stern, confirms to Dr. Zola, it has been given. Zola nods, satisfied. Good, he replies, his voice clipped. Schmidt gestures toward an artist's portrait of himself, a hint of pride in his tone. Dr. Zola, what do you think? Zola's eyes gleam with quite a bit of fear and horror as he studies the painting. A masterpiece, he says. The scene shifts to a car driving through Brooklyn's familiar streets. Steve Rogers, seated beside Peggy Carter, gazes out the window, recognizing the neighborhood. I know this neighborhood. I got beat up in that alley. And that parking lot. And behind that diner, he says, pointing out each spot with a wry tone. Peggy glances at him, curious. Did you have something against running away? She asks, her voice teasing but gentle. Steve's expression hardens with resolve. You start running, they'll never let you stop. You stand up, you push back. They can't say no forever, right? He says, his words steady. Peggy nods, a flicker of understanding in her eyes. I know a little of what that's like, she begins, her tone soft, connecting with his determination.
My first thought watching this minute in preparation was, and we might have said this before, I don't remember, how much Toby Jones is the Peter Lorre of this movie.
Yes.
if Peter Lorre were still alive, he'd be playing this part.
That's a great point. I don't think you've brought that up. I hadn't thought of that.
He's just such
feel really bad if you have and I just missed it or forgot.
He's
but
just
anyway.
Such a squeaky little weasel, so obsequious, and it's a delightful portrayal. I've seen Toby Jones in other things where he's did nothing like this, but he's in this movie, right. Man, he's got the Peter Lorre part down.
Yeah, and he's definitely.
He's become one of those guys for me, maybe I should say he's sort of rapidly becoming one of those. If he's in it. I want to watch it sort of thing. I think about him in the Detectorists. I thought it didn't stay quite as good as it started, but I thought Wayward Pines, if either of you saw that, that short-lived series, I thought that was fantastic. And Toby Jones was great in that. But, you know, the Detectorists is just a peculiar masterpiece.
Yeah, he's got it's like a Gary Oldman type. He just kind of loses himself in the part. And, right. This job here of being a toady is so, it's so nice. He's just like you were saying, Brian, he's just such the ultra henchman. And, he'll do anything, no matter, he doesn't need any morals to get things done. He's on his own little path. And we'll see that, right. All through this film, he just keeps, he's so focused on his own mission that, none of this matters.
But the way he plays it, you can tell that he's not too sure about what the Red Skull's up to. I mean, Zola's loyalty is to Hitler. But he's like more or less thinking to himself, you can say like, are you sure you want to do that, boss?
Right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But he's I always think of Charlotte's Web. I'm thinking he's more like Templeton the Rat.
Yes.
It's like he's a schemer. He knows how to get what he wants, and it doesn't matter who he's working for, as we'll see in future movies. Whoever he's working for, as long as he can get his piece of the action, the thing that he wants to get done, then he'll salute any flag.
Right. Well, and Brian, you said that, you know, his loyalty is to Hitler, and I would maybe reshape that slightly and say that in the grand scheme of things, he's probably slightly more scared of Hitler than he is of Red Skull, but Red Skull is in the room right now.
Uh-huh.
And as Jim was saying, you know, he'll salute any flag, but I think he's a little bit loyal to science and this pursuit. There's this streak in him that wants the knowledge and the technology and wants to advance things, but he's also quite interested in saving his own skin.
Yeah, that's not his department, as it were. So
I was just going to say we've talked about von Braun before, but it's the idea that existed in real life in this era of, for example, German scientists who maintained all they cared about was building rockets. It's not my department, said Werner von Braun.
Exactly.
You know, once the rockets go, who cares where they come down, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. And to what extent they were culpable for the crimes of their regime is a matter of history still debates, but some.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in Reaching for the Moon was his book, and somebody wrote underneath it, I sometimes hit London. So,
yes, exactly. Yeah. I will say one other quick thing about Toby Jones that, probably not now, but I don't know if it would be 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was some point where if, God forbid, somebody had decided to go out and remake MASH, I would vote for him all day, every day as Radar O'Reilly.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of the second coming of Gary Berghoff.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, or I was thinking if he were 40 years ago, he could be a great Tote from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh,
yep. He reminds me of Timothy Spall, if you know him, the British actor.
Yeah, I can see that.
He gets the same kind of parts. He was, what did he play in Harry Potter? Timothy Spall. He was Mad-Eye Moody.
The rat guy. Yeah.
Oh, Mad-Eye Moody. Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Was he? No,
he wasn't Mad-Eye Moody.
No. He was the rat-looking fellow.
All right, delete the whole thing, Jim.
Yeah, okay.
But Timothy Spall was in that, and I've also seen him in other movies where he plays completely different characters, heroic characters, even almost leading man characters. And he's, you know, like Toby Jones, not a conventionally handsome man, but they can just play anything.
Yeah, well, Timothy Spall, I think of him mostly in the movie Enchanted. He was...
Yes, he was the lackey in Enchanted, exactly right. That's right.
And excellent. I mean, he looks like a cartoon character, you know, and he's been very well cast in just about everything I've ever seen him in.
Yep. Yep.
But I think we can all agree that Toby Jones is perfect for this movie.
Yes.
And it would have been, you know, we could go back and forth through time, but how many times have we said over and over, Jim, through three of shows about Johnston's movies? It's just that there's not a bad bit of casting in the bunch.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I agree wholeheartedly.
Speaking of the director, he did some neat things in this movie, and we touched on them a little bit as we were preparing, but the whole business about the portrait painting, I think, is just lovely. It's beautifully done in this minute of the movie. You know, the first thing we see is the palette of the painter. The colors he's using to paint this portrait of the Red Skull. And he's using reds and grays and browns, and it looks like exploded roadkill on his palette. And right there, I'm sorry, cut, please. I'm getting some weird messages on my computer. Can you still hear and see me?
Yeah, you're fine.
All right, you're going to have to edit this out. I'm getting a lot of pop-ups and crap, so excuse me. All right. So you see this palette, and it tells you what the painter's looking at without having to see what he's looking at. We never see the Red Skull in this minute of the movie. All we see is his silhouette backlit by the Nordic sky behind him. We see the colors of the palette. We see how uneasy Zola is when the lights go up. We see the painter flinch or cringe when he gets a good look at Red Skull's face, but we never see the Red Skull's face, and it's really brilliant. It's making the viewers use their imaginations to conjure how horrible this visage must be.
Yeah, that radio theater.
Yeah, it's almost radio theater. Our imagination is so much worse than anything a makeup artist could come up with in this moment. And it builds the suspense. Oh, my God, what is this guy going to look like when we actually get to see him?
Yeah. One of the things that this reminded me of was Tim Burton, the 1989 Batman, when the first time we're going to see the Joker, his inept plastic surgeon said, "Well, look what I had to work with." And he points at what looks like the same palette that this artist is using. There's like a pile of rags and blood and what looks like, you know, grease paint all over a dirty table. And that's what this feels like. The artist has to use these globs to make the red skull or make some kind of a simulacrum, that's the word, of the red skull.
And in that scene in Batman, you know, again, we don't see the Joker right away there either. You know, Jack Nicholson has like, you know, mirror, you know, the mirror, he has to say it again. And then he looks and smashes it and we hear him laughing. But unless I'm grossly misremembering, we haven't quite got a glimpse of him at that point yet.
Yeah. Right? It's a nice anticipation of horror. Yeah. So
it's a really, really good comparison. I like the joke. I hadn't thought of that, but I think you're right on.
I have to ask, Brian, as an artist, is portraiture a difficult field to do?
Yeah, it is. Well, I had a high school art teacher who told me, "I can teach you anything about art except how to get a likeness." And his theory of art was that was something you were either born with or not. That, you know, you could learn any technique, you learn anything you want, but to get a likeness was the magic voodoo he couldn't teach you. And I don't know if that's right. I mean, I've met other, as a professional cartoonist, I've met caricaturists who are very good and can teach you to do it. Tom Richmond works with Mad Magazine. He's got a whole book on how to caricature. I will say I am not good at capturing a likeness. It's not a strength of mine. I can work and struggle and maybe get something you say, "Oh, that looks a little like Elvis." But, you know, there are people, I've seen people do a 3-line sketch with a ballpoint pen and you say, "Oh, Margaret Thatcher." I mean, you just get it. You look at it and you get it. And to me as an artist, that's a special skill, a special gift, a special kind of magic that I lack and some have. And so I don't know if I agree with my teacher, my old high school teacher. I think I agree more with Tom Richmond that it can be taught if you work at it. I've never worked at it. But some people are so good at it. And of course, a good portrait is really it's not a caricature, but it's most artists know to goose the recipe a little bit, to make the subject look a little better than maybe they really do.
Yeah, I think you did that with our logo artwork.
And I was going to say, Brian, you've done you did logos for our first two shows. You did the logo for this one. You know, we see your Christmas cards and the other things that you do. You capture yours and your family's likeness in that beautifully stylized comic way, in that, well, that Fies-esque way, I guess, if you name a style after you. And what impresses me about that, not just randomly blowing sunshine your way, but you can, you're doing what you're sort of talking about other people being able to do, is you're doing a very simple drawing, but it's, I recognize you instantly out of it.
Appreciate that. Thank you. That's me and my family. That's, I've been in situations where I'm out in public and I'm doing sketches for people or I'm doing drawings for them. And every time somebody says, "Draw me," my heart just sinks. And I can do it and they walk away happy, but I just am not at all comfortable trying to do that.
You're like those Amazon tribes that you feel that you're stealing their soul or something when you get out your pen and
uh-oh. No, I just think I suck.
Well, there is that. So speaking of feeling like you suck, you know, Brian, you were talking about high school art teachers, and that brought to mind a very short story for me, which may end up bridging the two halves of this minute. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But so I was thinking back, not even so much of a story, but thinking back to my high school art teacher, a lovely old woman of probably 21 named Miss Blodgett. And we had, you know, all different sorts of assignments and media, things like that. It was never a strong suit of mine. It was always sort of interesting. My cat has a lot to add. But there was an assignment to do something in sort of a relief. And I don't know if it was plaster or what it was we were working on, but basically it was making a, you know, we probably used a styrofoam meat tray as a base. And then you just have this sort of rectangle of this plaster material, and then carving things out, and then painting some 2.5D details. And I made this scene of this dragon, and I thought it was halfway decent, and I was fairly happy with it. And then one of the bullies comes along, and his artwork had not worked, and he was mad, and he saw mine looked halfway decent. And I'm not going to mention his name for reasons that'll become clear in a moment. So he looked at mine, looked at his, and then he just smashed mine before it could be graded. He just absolutely destroyed it. And that was, you know, pretty unhappy about that. And of course, here's Miss Blodgett trying to comfort me. And I'm trying to explain, no, it was really good. Maybe I can glue it back together. This thing is in a million pieces. But anyway, so that was, you know, that was art class, but there was, you know, there was somebody who was a pretty serious bully in my school, and his story went very, very dark right after high school, like extremely dark, probably too dark for this show, but he got involved in drug dealing. A deal went bad and he was thrown off a bridge.
Oh my goodness.
Wow. To his demise. I wouldn't wish that on anybody, but if you had asked me at any point from third grade on, which one of our classmates is going to go this direction and get himself in that position, that would have been this guy.
Well, sounds like the old ostensible Mark Twain quote of, I've never wished anyone dead, but I've read some obituaries with great pleasure.
Yes. Well put.
Wow. I think the second, it's funny. I think no matter how small you are, or how big you are, I think every guy can relate to the I got beat up in this alley in that parking lot and things. You've always when you get into situations where you've had confrontations with people, you always remember the what the weather was like, what the, you know, maybe what you were wearing, what the, you know, everything that happened at that. And you know, here you are half a century on, and it's still, if you there might be some, like, you know, Susquehanna Hat Company keyword in your head that goes, wait, oh, I remember that day. I remember it was a Thursday and it was raining. And it's just, it's strange how that, I don't think it affects, like, it doesn't affect your day-to-day stuff, but it will put your mood into an instant funk just thinking about something that happened when you were basically a little kid. And
I think it shapes who you are. It you know, like Steve Rogers, it maybe makes you a more empathetic person than you might otherwise be.
Yeah. And, you know, you hope that you weren't somebody else's bully, that you might not even have known that you said the wrong thing, or you said somebody that ruined their day. And, you know, you don't know those that happened at a particular time. But I keep thinking there's some kind of you know, bullying is awful, but I think it when you're bullied as a kid, I think, you know, hopefully you learn from it. You say to yourself, I've got to avoid people like this, or I've got to not be like that person.
Well, you get fine tuned to spot the signs too. You recognize bullies the rest of your life, I think.
Right. Yeah. It's good clues on things, and you learn not to engage in things like that. Or,
well, I learned Steve's lesson. I had I was bullied occasionally, and every time I confronted the bully in some way, I more or less won it, and not even physically. In seventh grade, there was a larger, you know, bigger eighth grade kid who used to follow me home, and I'm riding my bike, and he'd ride his bike right behind me and rear end me and bump me and nudge me and just hassle me all the way home, and never say anything, but just hassle me all the way home. And one day I'd had a tough day. I don't remember why, but something hadn't gone right, and I just stopped the bike, and I just turned around and said, hey, Greg, could you give me a break? I had a rough day. This is, could you just back off for one day? And he never bothered me again. Because I stopped the bike and I turned around and just said, not cool, dude.
And so there you go.
And just that act was showed enough gumption, I guess, that he just said, well, I'll go find some other prey, you know?
I mean, they got to say no sometime, right?
That's the lesson Steve teaches us in this minute.
That was the line. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's funny. We're going to have him as a guest right now. Just coming into the studio. No,
yeah. Exactly. Here's your childhood bully.
Right. Brian Fees, this is your life.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's one of those things you look back and you think I was either powerless to stop something or I should. I think what you do is you run through a million scenarios where you say, I should have done this or should have done that. But you know, it's like time flows and getting over it, I think it helps you grow into maturity of saying, I can't let the past alter who I am. Yeah. You know, it does though, but I think like right. Steve says here that, you know, if you start running, if you try to get away from it, it's just going to be a pursuit.
Yeah. I found too, Jim, and maybe this was true for you as well, Jim, that having my own kids gave me a lot of insight into my own childhood. It made me a lot more forgiving of myself and things I wish I'd done different or better or handled better or differently, because I saw my kids go through some of this stuff. And of course they don't know what to do. They're 9 years old. They're 12 years old. They're 14 years old. They've never done this before. Of course they're not going to get it right every time. And it just made me kind of look back at young me and say to myself, God, you were just a kid,
yeah. You know?
And I thought of that when you said, you know, maybe one would hope we weren't bullies to other people. Well, I think I might have been, especially when I was very young, like third, fourth grade. I think I was cruel to some children, and I deeply regret that. But at the same time, you know, I was 8 or 9 years old, and I have to give myself the grace to allow myself those mistakes. I mean, I wish I could take it back, but I can't. I don't even remember who those kids were, but, you know, learn and grow, right?
Yeah.
Try to become better people.
Yeah. It's difficult. I grew up, I went to a Catholic school and I had nuns, and every story you ever heard about nuns, they were true in many cases. I've been hit in the head with wooden handled erasers by, you know, tossed by 70-year-old nuns that could have been outfielders for the Giants, and and it was, you know, it's like my parents were, you know, had no level of violence. I wasn't spanked and things like that, but it was like these nuns had they all had this, you know, well, not all of them. Many of them were kind and wonderful, but some of them were like, I think they were using little kids as their therapy sessions, and it was very physical therapy. But, you know, and I didn't understand this until I was much older, that, you know, maybe they were in a vocation that their families may have forced them into it, and they didn't want to be where they were, and they had all these little kids around them, and it was driving them up the wall. But I, you know, at the time I was like, how do I survive this? These people are not acting like my mom and dad. But I, you know, as you know, it was kind of like as you got older, they weren't acting that way as much.
I think we've all went to school with that group of kids who, when the time came to read Lord of the Flies, you know, there was a couple of kids that, oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I can't wait. Yeah. You know, the darker and the gorier it gets.
Yeah, I need those glasses. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Hey, Piggy, hand them over. It sucks to your asthma.
Sorry, Hal. No, I want to make a couple corrections before we end this episode, which, you know, may come soon. Mad-Eye Moody was played by Brendan Gleeson.
Yes.
And Toby Jones played the voice of Dobby the House Elf.
Really?
In Harry Potter.
Wow. Okay, that's my
thing. He was in it, but not in physically.
Wow. Okay.
And Mr. Sprawl, we decided, played...
He played the mousy-looking fellow. He had, like, buck teeth and things. Well, you've got IMDb open.
We're watching Brian scroll fast. Scroll, Brian, scroll.
I'm thinking that our listeners are probably yelling, screaming at their earbuds as they trudge on their Peloton.
Let's see. Ah, Peter Pettigrew.
Peter Pettigrew.
Wormtail. You're exactly right.
Wormtail.
Timothy Spall is Wormtail.
Yes. What a great name.
All right. So we straightened out all the skeevy, obsequious actors.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Next time, everybody in their place.
While we're talking about this second half of the minute, I just want to say that I love everything about the relationship between Peggy Carter and Skinny Steve.
Yes.
Because She sees him. She sees the strong man inside him in a way that only Bucky and Dr. Erskine do. She's one of the few people in the world who really get him. And she got him while he was small and weak. And yeah. It's just such a special, gentle, I would say loving relationship even before he becomes a super soldier.
Yeah, and she's very, very much a calming influence with him. He's nervous about this whole thing. He knows he volunteered, but she's talking with him in such a soothing manner, and you know, like you said, a gentle way of keeping him calm during what is obviously going to be one of the most traumatic moments in his life.
Right. And you know, we see him, you know, earlier on stammering and the whole, you know, I don't know why a dame, I mean a beautiful, I, you know, that whole shtick that he does, but it's, we keep seeing him like almost in spite of himself, like everything in his background and his experience says, I've got to be just awkward and like that in front of this beautiful woman. But then in this minute, he's got that, you know, great bit of resolve about, you know, you can't run away forever. You can't, and you've got to do this. You've got to, and there's so much conviction there that it's, she's bringing that out of him, but it's almost like he's forgetting for just a moment that she is this beautiful woman and that he, yeah. Now I'm going to rephrase that. He's not forgetting that she's a beautiful woman. He's forgetting that he's supposed to be awkward around her.
Yeah,
he's being natural with her in spite of himself, and the strength that she sees, that Erskine sees, that Bucky sees, and that Steve may or may not always see in himself. But that's coming through right at the end of this.
I love it. And without being too, you know, on the nose, he's also doing a lot of exposition in stating his credo. Like, right. I am not going to back down, because if I do back down, they'll never let me go. So,
Well, Steve's not looking at Peggy when he says that at the end. He's looking out the car window, but Peggy's looking at him, and you can just see that she's thinking, we got the right guy, you know?
Right. Yeah. And she's starting to think, maybe I've got the right guy.
Maybe.
Yeah. And the other thing is that I was thinking about with this little moment of the men, as you know, people always have this thing when they're about to experience a traumatic event. The saying is, your life flashes in front of your eyes. And here it's literally flashing in front of Steve's eyes as he's going, I got beat up there. I got hit here. And then that alley. And it really, this is the time before the trauma. So just a beautiful minute as they all have been in this first half hour, but we've got,
absolutely,
we've got plenty of more minutes to come. So, and we do appreciate the audience sticking by with us as we go through our own personal traumatic stories. So thanks for joining us.
Share yours with us online.
Yes. Yes. We do look forward to your traumas. So, but it's always intriguing to see where this is. And also like, you know, how it shaped you, how did dealing with bullies change your life? But also, thanks for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, as we'd love you to do, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.